I thank the organizers for inviting me to come and speak again. I'm very different, as I sort of alluded to this morning when I spoke. I'm somebody who goes all over the place, and I see salmon populations across the whole range of the species. And so I don't have a great deal of knowledge of individual populations, but I'm able to put populations into a perspective, and that is my... What I will try to do today is to give you a bit of a perspective that you can put the Allier population into, which will perhaps help you to understand why it's special and perhaps see some of the things that might be important about it and help you to manage it better. So I'm just going to give you, start at a very broad overview. If you look at this picture here in the red, you will see the distributional range in modern times of the Atlantic salmon. You'll see some areas like the Rhine and the Elbe where it's a bit hatched, where we no longer have the populations. And in some of those red areas, there are now also, if you updated them, there are areas where populations no longer exist. What most people won't appreciate, if you look at the map with the green there, is that there are hundreds of populations of Atlantic salmon that never go to sea at all. They could go to sea, but they don't. And there are some special areas in the range of the Atlantic salmon where they behave. They are adapted to a non-migratory existence. It tells you something about the potential of the salmon to adapt its lifestyle to different circumstances. It's quite powerful. If you look at the white map, this is a summary of the WWF that was produced approximately 10 years ago, which gives you an overview of the conservation status of populations across the range. And the message basically is that virtually everywhere, with a few exceptions like northern Russia, the populations have to some degree been impacted by human activities or natural circumstances, but mostly human activities, in a way that they are not what they used to be, and therefore there is interest in restoring them to their former natural condition of abundance or character. Now, there's two requirements for success, and I'm only going to deal with the one of them, scientific understanding. Now, for some people, science is a bit of a dirty word, but science really is just about thinking about things carefully, objectively, and logically, and gathering evidence and acting on that evidence, and not just on what I would call fishermen's stories. But at the same time, you need political will and popular support if you're going to get restoration. But that's completely a different ballgame than science. It's not one that I'm involved with. But it's just as important. Now, my main interest, and one of the things which I think underlies a lot of the concerns that we have with regard to restoration, and certainly is relevant to the previous talk on the issue of adaptation to increasing water temperatures, is the capacity of populations to adapt to changing environmental circumstances, the capacity of populations to adapt to introductions of farm fish, of stocked fish, etc. What we have to realize is that adaptation is really about something that has evolved over thousands and thousands of years, where you have a natural gene pool in a river such as the Allier, and you have a naturally evolved environment, and they have co-evolved together, and this constitutes a healthy population. And in the case of an anadromous salmon, you have these native eggs, and the environment involves not only the river, but the sea as well. And in the case of the Allier, that means the sea all the way up to Spitsbergen in West Greenland. That's an important part of what it is adapted to go there and to come back and then survive in the river. If you're a non-anadromous population, you have life a lot easier. You might not go more than 100 meters, and you would only have to adapt to that particular little piece of river or that little lake in that area where you are. So different adaptational challenges. And each population has a unique gene pool, it's in a unique environmental context, more or less, to varying degrees. And this interaction between the environment and the genes is unique in each case. And that's what defines the health, the abundance, and the character of the population. Now, to show you the kind of variation that we're talking about across the range, I produced this diagram with Patrick a year or two ago, just to really look at the migration challenge that anadromous populations, different ones, have, to put the allié into perspective. So if you look at the what will be the left hand of the diagram below there, you'll see the relative distance of the freshwater migration from the spawning grounds in the allié to where it has to go in the sea and then come back again. And across there, you'll see populations in different parts of the range, and you'll see that there is a huge variation in the environments that these rivers, or that these river stocks or populations actually have to deal with in completing their life cycle. And when you look at that geographical range, you can only imagine that a big component of that capacity to deal with this different environmental challenge in each case has a heritable component to it. It is something that is unique heritably to that population of salmon. What's more important in terms of restoration is the concept of maladaptation. As my colleague Carlos García de Llanes would say, adaptation is fine. We're given that. The problem is when we have maladaptation. And we can get maladaptation in two ways. The first of them is changing the gene pool. We can have the right environment, and if we have the right gene pool, we get Atlantic salmon. But if we have the wrong gene pool, we don't get any salmon at all, because they're just not ready to cope with that environment. They haven't evolved to deal with it. We can also get maladaptation through changing the environment. Like the allié, we can have the right DNA. It's been there for 100,000, 200,000. So there is limits to adaptation, but it's the maladaptation that we have to deal with and that we have to address. When you management options, when you change, you have a change of gene pool. This can happen when you have deliberate or inadvertent introductions of non-native fish, fish of low genetic variability, an inbred hatchery strain, or if you reduce the population down to a very low level and you just have brothers and sisters left and they inbreed. The ability to diagnose those problems, it's largely drawn from inferences, though increasingly we have molecular markers, as Guillaume referred to, that allow us to assess to some extent the genetic character and the genetic health of populations. Our current options for dealing with changes to the gene pool are almost always limited to withdrawing whatever the problem is and then hoping that the population can recover. We have a very, very limited capacity to try and engineer a population back to the way it was. The Atlantic salmon genome is twice as big as the human genome. Every Atlantic salmon is unique. It's got 58 chromosomes. It's twice as big as the human chromosome, or twice as many as the human chromosomes. Our knowledge of Atlantic salmon genetics is a fraction of that of humans. We cannot engineer human genomes. We cannot do it with Atlantic salmon genomes. We are best to leave the gene pools and the genomes alone as best we can. Mind you, that is not always possible. Our future options, increasingly we're starting to understand what the genetic basis of local adaptation is, and Guillaume again referred to one gene that we know that's involved in adaptation, but there are a lot of others, and in the next 5 years we will have suites of genes that we know in some way are important to adapting salmon to their environments. With that knowledge, we may increasingly be able to understand what goes wrong in populations. Management options when it comes to the change in the environment relative to gene pool management, that looks incredibly simple, but of course our previous speaker made it very clear that that is far from a simple problem. However, it's a much easier problem to understand, and probably the biggest challenge is the political will and to actually move forward with the environmental changes. Though often you're going to have to identify what a particular environmental factor is that might be the most critical factor. In the future, we'll learn more, but probably the situation isn't going to change hugely. But in the meantime, adaptation tells us that our biggest effort should go into addressing environmental issues, because that's where we actually have the power to do something to change the maladaptation back into adaptation. Now, a year ago, with Patrick Martin and a number of others, we set up a group called SALARC, the Atlantic Salmon Adaptation Research Consortium, to try and get a pan-European initiative to understand adaptation in Atlantic salmon, how populations are different, and how important this is in the management of populations and in the restoration of populations. And in June, we met for the second time, and we had a series of case studies that we reviewed to try and define the way forward with regard to research programs, recognizing that given the limitations of funding for species like salmon and the limitations in the numbers of research groups involved, that our best chance to move science forward was to link together into a network in Europe and also with our partners in North America, to the extent that that's possible, and to develop research programs that will help us restore. I'm just going to give two examples of research that were presented at this meeting. The first one is Ireland, which was a transplant experiment, which is very informative, and I was going to talk about the Common Garden experiment of Guillaume Ivano, but he already mentioned three-quarters of it, so that will make my talk a little bit shorter. You'll be lucky. So the first talk is by Phil McGinnity and his co-workers in Ireland. Phil is one of the leading population geneticists working on Atlantic salmon. Many will be familiar with his work. One of the things that they did there was they compared the fitness, the survival from egg to adult, of a non-native population in a river called the Owenmore, just near to a river called the Burrishool, and they compared it in the Burrishool. So they took a non-native fish and put it in a river with a native fish, and they compared it from the egg stage through to the adult stage. And what they found was that the native salmon had superior lifetime fitness to this neighboring population, and hybrids were intermediate, but closer to the overall native population. But what you can see in here is that the fitness of the non-native population over the whole lifetime was less than a quarter of what the fitness of the wild native population was. And this is the reflection of the degree of local adaptation. And when you remember that this is a river that is virtually next to this other river, that's a huge, big difference in fitness. This really illustrates, and there are many other studies that show this kind of thing as well, that this the difference between a native gene pool and a non-native gene pool and their ability to produce salmon is huge. Now, this is the study that Guillaume mentioned earlier. The one thing he didn't mention here was that while he didn't find differences between populations in their responses to normal oxygen levels or low oxygen levels, what he did find was that there was a difference in the interaction between the population and the oxygen conditions. So the response wasn't always the same, that one population shifted in a certain way and the other population shifted in the same way. Some populations showed a different response to different conditions. Another example of an important adaptive difference between populations. Now, I've given you two examples here. I could spend the next 2 days giving you examples. That's not my point. My point is that these studies that are being done by independent researchers in various places in Europe and in North America need to be brought together, and we need to see what they tell us collectively about the Atlantic salmon, its character, how it adapts, and how we need to manage this, and how this knowledge can actually help us to move restoration programs forward and make them more successful. Now, another way of moving information forward is through case studies. Now, ICES recently set up a working group called the Working Group on the Effectiveness of Recovery Actions for Atlantic Salmon. And this was set up with recognition that recovery and building programs for Atlantic salmon have not been thoroughly reviewed and evaluated in respect of their results. So what we haven't done is taken all this collective knowledge from the various restoration programs across the whole of the salmon range and said, what is it that works and what is it that doesn't work? What's generally the case? What's unique to a particular population? But ICES is now setting on that task and is going to review this, and hopefully from this we will start to get a better general understanding that can help us all. And it can lead to this classification of activities that can be recommended and that would benefit management generally. So I'll give you two recent case studies. One is from Norway, which relates to the recovery from acidification. The second one is from Denmark, which relates to the recovery from habitat degradation and non-native stocking. So the case study from acidification relates to work that was done by Kjetil Hindar and his group in Nina at Trondheim. It's in southern Norway, where they had two rivers that were limed, and they were actually then the acid levels of the water were brought back up to normal conditions, and they then had active programs of stocking and looked at the recovery. And the conclusion of basically of this study was that in one case, the river actually didn't need the stocking. The stocking did not contribute to the recovery of the river. The recovery was entirely due to recolonization from neighboring rivers that still had populations. But in the case of the second river, the result was that a substantial part of the recovery of the river was due to the stocking of fish. Part of it was due to natural recolonization, part of it not. The interesting thing here is to pull out is why the two rivers are different and what we can learn about that. The second one is the river on the Skjerne River in Denmark. This is work by Einar Nielsen and his colleagues there. Much of it's been published. In this case, they had a river in which the population was very severely depressed, probably of a similar extent to the Allier, but on a much smaller scale. And they looked at it and they found the same thing when they looked at it genetically, that there was still this native, genetically unique population in the Skjerne, despite years and years of stocking salmon from other from Norway and other places. The native gene pool was retained, probably because it was fit and adapted for that river. So they then set up a program of restocking and habitat rehabilitation in order to bring that river back up to its former glory. But of course, had they just done a stocking program, it would have been insufficient. What they needed was the habitat to be restored, the survival rates to increase, and the capacity of the river to hold salmon to increase. And what they have found so far is what they are doing is being successful. And this may be a study that would be of particular interest to the Allier, and I would recommend that people from the Allier actually probably go to Denmark and look at the Skjerne program and see if there are things there to be learned. There are a lot of other studies I could mention, but I won't. But this is just an example of the type of thing that is out there that would help the Allier probably to decide what the best way forward is. So advancing understanding is terribly important, and there's two initiatives that are out there. One is SALARC, which is going to advance the science, bring new science to bear on it, and the other one is the Widgerass initiative from ICES, which will look retrospectively at what has been done and what we can learn from what has been done already. What's the relevance to the Loire Allier salmon restoration? Well, I think for me it's that just like this program is bringing people together from Germany, myself from Scotland, from other places, if we do this and we continue to exchange information, we can advance restoration science and we can help to solve these problems associated with maladaptation and have a much clearer vision and a greater confidence about the way forward and have greater successes. Thanks for your attention.